It's Up First Sunday. I'm Rachel Martin. It has been a year since the fall of Kabul. The Taliban captured the capital on August 15th, and by the end of the month, the U.S. had pulled out all of its troops. In the space of two chaotic weeks, America had evacuated more than 100,000 civilians from Afghanistan. It was dangerous and embarrassing for America. A year has passed, and my colleague Steve Inskeep traveled to Afghanistan to report on what it looks like there. Steve, what did you focus your reporting on? Because there were obviously so many questions about what Afghanistan would look like after the Taliban took over again.
Well, we paid such close attention, Rachel, to the people last year who were getting out or who were desperately trying to get out. I wanted to report on the people who remained. I felt a duty to tell that part of the story, and I felt that it had been undertold despite a lot of brave reporting by a lot of people over the last year. And so we went to Taliban-governed Afghanistan asking who is included in this new regime, who has a place at the table, who has freedom, who has opportunity, and also who doesn't.
So where do you begin to answer a question like that?
Well, it would be tempting to start at the top with the Taliban officials themselves. And we're going to get there. In fact, we're going to talk to one of the most senior Taliban officials, a member of an iconic and powerful family. But really, a better place to begin is among ordinary people on the streets of Kabul. We talked with shopkeepers on a retail street in Kabul. In a used furniture store, Abdul Kahar said he's not selling much because nobody has the money to buy. Are people bringing you more furniture to sell so that they can have money? Yes, he says. Some sell furniture to buy food. Some sell because they're leaving the country. 10 days ago, one family sold their furniture and only afterward learned of problems with their visas to Europe. Abdul Kahar studied political science and law in college, but selling furniture is the only job he can find. His business partner is Wahid Kashafi.
How much longer can you go on?
I don't know, maybe a year, two. Finally, I will escape.
He says he'd prefer a more inclusive country where girls as well as boys can study and where there's democracy. Afghanistan used to have a parliament, and we met one of its former members. Gulalai Mohammadi is one of the women who seized the opportunities under the previous government. She started her working life as a midwife. Do you sometimes see a little girl or a little boy and say, I delivered that one?
Of course. I see four child in my home that I delivered.
Children of her relatives. She later found a job in flight safety at an airport. And then she went into politics.
I was the youngest member of parliament.
For which she paid a price as the Taliban advanced.
In 2020, the Taliban killed my brother.
What?
My youngest brother because of me. He was newly married, so they killed him in Kandahar province.
You think that he was killed because of his relation to you?
Of course. They told me, they called me that now we killed your brother. The second is your number. Be ready.
What was lost that there was a parliament before and now there's nothing?
See, today I'm at home. I cannot do anything for women. From this, we know that we lost everything, especially women.
Other Afghans we met said they are satisfied with the change in power, but they face the challenge of living in a country devastated by war. Consider a rural village south of Kabul. Our producer, Fazil Kazizai, pointed out that village along Highway 1.
This is one of the main villages, which is entirely destroyed, you can see.
The highway is cratered and blackened from years of Taliban bombs. The village is ruined because the U.S.-backed Afghan government bulldozed many of the mud-walled homes. As we stood there, a young man emerged from one of the houses still standing.
Is life better now than it was before the collapse?
Yes, it's much better. It's security. It's peace. There's no robbery. No thieving. We are very happy.
Mohammed Yassad was holding a math book and said he's preparing to graduate from high school.
So if you're 18, for Afghanistan, the median age is 18. How do you feel about your future?
I'm hopeful. I want to be a very big man in the future.
His future opportunities depend on how the Taliban govern. So we asked to meet Mohammad Yaqub, the interim defense minister. His job title only captures part of his significance. He is considered the group's number three leader and also is the son of the Taliban's former emir. He said we'd find him outside the capital in the southern city of Kandahar.
This city is a bit smaller, a bit shabbier than Kabul, and yet somehow livelier. It is not the official center of power, but it is the center of power for the Taliban.
The defense minister didn't tell us in advance where we would be meeting.
Okay, so we've just left the hotel and we've been told in our vehicle to follow this black car that came to guide us to wherever the defense minister may be here in Kandahar.
It's an old insurgent's security technique. We found out his location only when we arrived. Our producer Fazil was the first one to realize where we were going.
To the old house of Mullah Omar.
We're going to the old house of Mullah Omar?
Just here.
Mullah Mohammed Omar, the defense minister's father. Omar was the leader of the Taliban the last time they ruled Afghanistan. He was the leader who refused to turn over Osama bin Laden in 2001, a refusal that led to the U.S. attack. His tree-lined compound became a base for the CIA and its Afghan allies. Now, Omar's son has reclaimed his childhood home.
Bullet-riddled old walls.
The black car guided us to a gravel parking lot.
We're here.
And Mohammed Yaqub met us in a simple yellow room inside one of the buildings.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
By the name of God, thank you very much for coming here.
He's in his early 30s with a full black beard. He said he agreed to this meeting because he wants Americans to know the truth. And the truth is, the Taliban have not decided some of the key questions facing them. They have not agreed, for example, on what to do about girls in school. Some have been allowed to study, but many have not.
Many Afghans have told us they are concerned about girls not being in school. They would like all girls to attend school. Do you believe that that should happen?
This is a serious issue for us. There are some developments, and hopefully there will be more about it. We have discussion about these issues, and we are hoping that soon the ground will be prepared for that.
What makes it difficult simply to allow them to return to school?
The conditions are not ready. We need some basic condition for this issue.
Other Taliban officials told us they face a political problem. If they move too quickly in favor of girls in school, they might alienate some of their own ideologically trained gunmen. Yaqub's main job is defense, and the most serious threat comes from a branch of the Islamic State, or Daesh. They oppose the Taliban for dealing with the United States.
Does the United States offer or ask to cooperate with you against Daesh? And have you cooperated?
There was no help done by American with us against Daesh. And the only big help that the American can do with us against Daesh is that they should stop giving them more attention.
He did not address Al-Qaeda, whose leader the United States had killed that day in Kabul. Yaqub did address a United Nations report accusing Taliban forces of killings and other human rights abuses.
Yes, a man among the men will commit violence, but immediately we are after them, arresting them and leading them to the court and punishing them for that.
What do you say to Afghans who are still afraid, who worked for the previous government, or who are women who lost their jobs, or who are members of minority sects, and feel insecure, feel that they could be attacked at any time? What do you say to them?
Repeatedly, we give them confidence that we will not walk out of violence. We will not walk out of revenge. This is our policy. Afghanistan is the home for all Afghans.
Would you welcome back anyone who fled?
I say welcome to all, to everyone.
Do you want the United States to recognize Afghanistan's new government as legitimate and establish normal relations?
Openly, of course, this is an obvious thing. And there are many countries that America is more against than us, but they recognize them officially. I think the recognition is a positive step toward a bigger change
U.S. diplomats have been meeting with the Taliban. The U.S. has released some economic aid to the devastated country and has talked of more. But the U.S. also wants to see proof that this regime governs differently than the Taliban of the past.
How, if at all, is your vision for Afghanistan different than your father's vision in the 1990s?
I haven't felt any changes in our thought with my father. I am following his path. But there is differences of situation, there is differences of condition.
That's Mohammed Yaqub, the son of one-time Taliban leader Mullah Omar, and now the interim defense minister.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much that you came here.
You're listening to Up First Sunday. I'm Rachel Martin with Steve Inskeep. We will be back after the break. This is Up First Sunday. I'm Rachel Martin, and today we are looking at Afghanistan. 1 year after the Taliban captured Kabul and U.S. troops pulled out after 20 years. Steve Inskeep recently traveled to Afghanistan to ask who was included in the Taliban's Afghanistan this time around. As part of that, he visited the studios of Tolo News. This was Afghanistan's first 24/7 news channel. It is still on the air. And when he was there, Steve met Toba Walizada, the network's education reporter. She's just 23 years old.
Why did you stay in journalism?
Because I would like to continue my struggle here. It's very hard for me to leave behind everything and go. I mean, if I leave, who will be the voice of Afghanistan? As you know, humans cannot struggle alone. And us women, we are especially alone for the struggle.
When the Taliban took power 1 year ago this month, they sent home many women from government jobs. They weren't allowed to share offices with men. Yet here's Toba in a private workplace. Just as with Afghan girls, some in school, others not, women's careers vary from office to office.
Since the Taliban took over, has anyone told you that you should not be working because you are a woman?
Yes, many times. In the early days when I joined the station, there were lots of protests of women, and I was there to cover them. A large number of Taliban foot soldiers were asking me, "Why are you here?" And they detained me in police headquarters.
She said the soldiers asked why a daughter, a girl, would be a reporter. But they let her go, and she returned to work.
Do you have any conservative members of your own family who have said you should not be doing this work?
Not my immediate family, but some in my larger family don't approve. My aunt and uncle are not aware that I am doing this work.
She says those relatives sympathize with the Taliban. She thinks they'd be ashamed if they turned on the TV at the wrong time. Her voice goes out in her reports, but she rarely does a stand-up that would show her face. The provisional government seems not to have settled on many firm rules for women working or not working. That leaves space for Toba Walizada, but it's had a different effect on Mujda Noor. She's from a family where the women have worked for generations.
My mother was a teacher. Also, my brothers and sisters, all of them are educated and went to university.
Mujda Noor attended college and eventually came to teach in one. And we spoke with her while driving in a car across Kabul. She told her story of living in a rural mountain province far to the east of the capital.
Where did you grow up?
Badakhshan.
In Badakhshan?
Yes.
How long have you been a university professor?
Almost 11 years.
Those 11 years mostly coincided with the old republic, which promised rights for women. The country was divided and the Taliban attacked, so she loved teaching about the American Civil War and how the United States unified afterward. Eventually, she became the Dean of Social Sciences at Badakhshan University. She was overseeing 19 male professors.
How did the men feel about having a woman as their boss?
At first, they could not. As you know, Badakhshan is a rural province, and also most of them are very religious men. And at first, they didn't accept me.
but she showed them a letter from the Ministry of Higher Education confirming her authority. She says she paired that letter with a friendly, reassuring attitude, although she dressed as she wanted.
I could lead them and manage the affairs about 3 years.
For 3 years?
For 3 years, yes.
But then 1 year ago, the government changed, and so did her male colleagues. A new chancellor took charge, a professor she'd known in past years from the religious law faculty.
And he said to me, you are my former colleague, and also we should have friendly relations, but I should say to you that now it's your job that priest students to cover black hijabs.
She was supposed to make sure that female students covered themselves and also make them come to campus only in the morning. Mujda herself, as a woman, should abstain from faculty meetings, even though she was a dean.
You can send your deputy then like this.
You could not attend meetings that were all male.
And they were very serious, very serious. I thought that my chancellor, his personality was completely changed before the Taliban, after the Taliban.
Really? And the same person?
Yes, and his behavior with me. Before that, he was friendly with me, and sometimes we talked with each other. But after that, no, he was a very dictator person.
Dictatorial?
Yes, yes.
We get out here?
Yeah.
Okay.
At the end of the car ride, we sat outside to talk a little more about what changed 1 year ago this August. Her colleagues at the university were all the same people. She'd known them for years. The rules under which they operated have not entirely changed, but she says their attitudes have.
Most of my colleagues, they completely changed now. They think they are very powerful, and this government is their governance, and also they have the right to push down others, to govern on others and manage others. They think like this. And in the past, they were a little good, like my chancellor, that he had a good behavior and also treat as a friend with me. But after the Taliban, they didn't like this.
After a few months, she felt unsafe in Badakhshan and says she tried to get a transfer to Kabul. She took leave, but the university dismissed her for missing work. She cannot say she was officially fired for being a woman, only that she's been fired. Now, the one-time dean of social sciences is looking for another job. And like other women we met, she is applying to foreign NGOs. She feels her chance of being hired by Afghan men is less than it was 1 year ago.
We've been hearing reporting from my colleague Steve Inskeep from his recent trip to Afghanistan. This is Up First Sunday. I'm Rachel Martin. Stay with us. This is Up First Sunday. I'm Rachel Martin, and today we are marking 1 year since the Taliban captured Kabul and U.S. forces left Afghanistan. Steve Inskeep recently traveled to the country to ask this question: who is included in the Taliban's Afghanistan? And Steve, are there Afghans who are optimistic about the Taliban, this version of it anyway?
Oh, there are Afghans who are happy with Taliban rule, and also Afghans who were happy with Taliban rule at the beginning, which is part of this next story we're going to tell. To find them, we went on a drive. You see one side of Afghanistan here in Kabul, a city of millions with crowded streets and neighborhoods that go up the sides of a mountain valley. We're heading to see a different side of Afghanistan, though, rural Afghanistan, where the conditions and the politics are very different. We drove Highway 1 south out of Kabul into Wardak province.
Really stark landscape, dry mountains, a bit greener down here in the valley. Sometimes we go through groves of trees near the riversides.
Every so often, we slowed down to maneuver past broken pavement. Those are the places where the Taliban set bombs on the road throughout a 20-year war.
We'll try not to crash into this bus that's swerving around the hole in the road.
About 50 miles outside Kabul, we entered another world, turning left into the Tangi Valley. Our producer, Fazal Minallah Kazizai, says this valley was once the stronghold of a Taliban commander.
There was a famous incident that he went and killed some American soldier, then put the legs and arms of some of them in the trees. So anyone driving to the valley could see them.
Hung them from these trees we're passing
Hung
now.
Them, yes, yes.
We drove up into the valley where water flows through irrigation ditches, sustaining crops of apricots, peaches, potatoes, and tomatoes. Between the tidy green fields, people live in mud-walled homes. And a man named Morsalim welcomed us into his guest room. He's well off, with a black turban and solar panels on the roof to power his well. He's decorated this room with a poster showing photos of Taliban leaders, including that famous commander, Fazal Rabi. He's holding the leg of an American soldier?
Yes. And this is his brother.
And this is Fazal
Rabi. It was the leader of American force.
It would be hard to prove the leg in that picture was from an American. U.S. troops try never to leave their dead behind. But the Taliban did kill Americans in this valley, once shooting down a helicopter with 38 people on board. Americans also killed many Taliban, including the famous commander and his successor, and his successor. Every man on this poster is dead.
Yes.
We sat on the floor with surviving Taliban fighters. One of them took out his phone and showed us old video of American soldiers firing into this same valley. It is video taken from an American base where troops seem to be shooting indiscriminately at a village. The fighter is Hadiatullah Wadad.
Yes, I did jihad against the U.S. forces, and for 5 times I was wounded during the fight.
He says he fought for years, in this valley and beyond, wherever they sent him. He fought Americans, he fought the old Afghan government, and even the Taliban's enemies in the Islamic State. What do you feel that you won in the end? He said, we expelled foreigners, we won a triumph, and we achieved an Islamic government. They also captured U.S.-made weapons, like the pistol he showed me. Smith & Wesson.
Yeah.
Springfield, Massachusetts, USA. The former Taliban fighters took us farther up the valley to one of their many shrines to the dead. Fazal Rabi, the famous commander, is buried in a cemetery on a dusty hilltop overlooking his valley. Morsalim, our host, buried his own brother beside him. Fazal Rabi is here, and this is your brother.
Yes.
How many of your brothers died in the war?
Two.
Two brothers?
Yes.
That's a big price to pay.
Yes, yes.
When you think back, was the sacrifice worth it?
Yes, why not?
Why not?
Why not?
The desert sun was beating down, so we sat on the covered porch of a little white mosque by the cemetery. When the Americans came and then stayed, they talked about democracy and freedom for Afghanistan. Does democracy mean anything to you? He said democracy comes from man and Islam comes from God, so Islam is better. The idea that democracy and Islam could be compatible, that the old Afghan government was an Islamic republic, was not the way that he thought about it. Later, we drove down out of the valley with Hekmatullah Waqid, a local journalist. He said people in this valley celebrated 1 year ago when the Taliban took power, but now attitudes are changing.
The people of villages are not very happy.
For two big reasons.
And not happy for economical problems and girls' education.
So people in this valley want their girls to go to school?
Yeah.
Unlike the old government, the Taliban have not let many girls return to school. They now face democratic pressure, calls from the public, from the media, even from religious scholars, to let girls study. We drove on and stopped at a village a little way outside the valley, back along Highway 1. In wartime, the Taliban planted bombs on the roadside here. So, according to residents, the old Afghan government bulldozed much of the village.
Assalamu alaikum. Hello.
One of the remaining residents came out of his mud-walled house. Sharif Nazari told us he's glad that peace has come, but he added that he's out of work.
I was engineer, road engineer.
Nobody has hired this road engineer to fix the battered highway that passes by. What do you want from the government, if anything? He says the government should pay to rebuild this village. Once he might have demanded that from the United States and its Afghan allies. Now the U.S. and the old republic are gone, meaning if anybody pays, it would be the Taliban. The old saying holds that to the victors go the spoils, and that may be true, though something else went to the victors in Afghanistan. They also faced the expectations of the people and the responsibility of governing, if they can.
There's so much unknown about how this whole thing is going to play out for the Afghans who are still there trying to make a life under the new Taliban. Steve, you spent time there, you know, right after the U.S. invasion. You were there reporting. I just wonder what your observations were sort of personally as you were trying to tell the story of Afghanistan now, especially in light of your past experience there.
I was struck by how many signs of my own country remain in this country that the United States abandoned, and in a very public way, with the planes coming in to take everything out that they could. And yet American-made weapons remain, and the memories of 20 years of war remain, and connections that people have with the United States in many cases remain. But there's another thing that I think about. I remember back in 2001, my colleague Ann Garrels, the great NPR war correspondent, and she went on the air and she said on a Sunday morning, as a matter of fact, on NPR to the host then, Leanne Hansen, "I'm about as far away from you as I possibly can be." And if you look on a map, Afghanistan seems like it's about as far away as you can be. And yet the human beings there face many of the same questions and struggles that we do. You have Afghans who are asking, how do I make democratic change in this country, even though the current government has said there is going to be no democracy? They are struggling with many of the same things that we are struggling. We are part really of a worldwide struggle about how we govern ourselves.
Well, we so appreciate your reporting. Steve Inskeep and his team reported from Afghanistan 1 year after the Taliban captured Kabul. Thanks so much, Steve.
I'm glad to do it, Rachel.
This episode of Up First Sunday was edited by Arzu Rizvani and Miranda Kennedy. It was produced by Taylor Haney and Justine Yan. I'm Rachel Martin. Up First will be back tomorrow with all the news you need to start your week. Have a good rest of your weekend.